Welcome to Move Wild Podcast. I'm your host, Jake Clapson. The aim of this podcast is to explore, learn, and spread the message of rewilding and natural movement so that we as humans can live in more alignment with our nature and reclaim what it means to be fully alive. The modern world has stripped away so much that used to nourish our mind, body, and soul. This podcast will help illuminate how we can reclaim and restore our innate, wild, capable, and strong spirit. Thanks for joining me on this journey. Hey guys, and welcome back to another episode of Move Wild Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. So for those of you who are new today listening to the show, I'll let you guys know a little bit about what Move Wild Podcast is about. So Move Wild Podcast is a podcast dedicating to understanding human health from an evolutionary perspective and integrating the universal principles of human health and wildness into our lives. Each week I interview and discuss with guests on topics and conversations focused around rewilding, natural movement, nature connection, and ancestral living practices. So thanks for joining me on this journey if you're new, and if you're a returning listener, then welcome back. So today I'm sharing an interview and a conversation that I recorded a while back with Dr. Bill Schindler. So Dr. Bill Schindler is the founder and director of the Eastern Shore Food Lab, an associate professor of anthropology and archaeology at Washington College in Chesterton, Maryland, and the co-star of the National Geographic series, The Great Human Race, Curiosity Stream's The Modern Stone Age Family, and Wired Magazine's Basic Instinct. He's a food archaeologist, primitive technologist, and chef. He travels the world documenting traditional food ways and works to draw inspiration from the deep archaeological record, rich and diverse ethnographic record, and modern culinary world to create food solutions that are relevant, meaningful, and accessible today. Bill is a strong advocate of traditional foodways and is constantly seeking new ways to incorporate lessons learned from his research into the diets of modern humans. His outlook on food has revolutionized the way in which he and his family eat, and he attributes much of the health his wife and three children enjoy to the nutrient-dense, hunted, gathered, and fermented foods that comprise a significant portion of their diets. He empowers people around the world to eat like humans again by reconnecting them with their food, past, environment, and communities through speaking, teaching, and writing. I'm really looking forward to seeing and hearing what you guys think of this episode, so let's jump into it. Listen in after the show for how you can connect with Dr. Bill and how you can connect with me.
Okay, so thank you, Dr. Bill Schindler, for coming on the show today.
That's my pleasure. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. So to start with, I'd like to get a little bit of your background and really how you got into this world of traditional food ways and primitive technology and eating nose to tail, and why you think those things are so important in your life.
Sure, I'd be happy to talk about that. So it's a lot, you know, there's a lot of pieces to this, and there's definitely a lot of things we can dive into much deeper as we move forward. But in general, I think the biggest takeaways from my journey that led to this point starts with connection, a connection with food and my relationship with food. And I started out in this search really to try to get a connection with food and diet and health. It seems like I've actually been trying to form that connection my entire life in some way. When I was younger, I was heavy. I was very awkward, pudgy kid that I got beat up quite a bit in school, unfortunately, and made fun of. And I had this really unhealthy relationship with food. Food to me wasn't something that nourished me. It was something that made me ugly and made me awkward and made other kids make fun of me. And then I became an athlete in high school, and I dove into wrestling, which was fantastic. And my body, the looks of my body transformed because I was working out three times a day. And my relationship with food transformed to something different, but it still wasn't a healthy relationship. Here I was feeling better about the way that I looked and maybe about the better way that I performed. But the relationship between food and wrestling is a very unhealthy one. And food was not something that made me ugly any longer. It was something that I was scared of. And the more that I ate, the more I wasn't going to make weight. The more I ate, the more I was going to sit with a rubber suit on and try to lose weight. And eventually, this persisted for some time. I ended up wrestling for both a Division I program at Ohio State. It was one of the best, top three programs in the country. And later on, a series of another events, I ended up wrestling also at the College of New Jersey, a great Division III program. So for almost a decade of my life, I felt fitter, right? But I had this really weird, awkward relationship with food that it was something that I tried to avoid. And then once I stopped being an athlete, after I graduated college, all the weight came back on. And I started to suffer from a lot of different metabolic diseases, from restless leg syndrome to irritable bowel syndrome and a bunch of other things, and was heavy again. So then food now again once was something that made me unattractive and made me feel bad and made me sick. So this entire time, I've been trying to answer this question in different forms. What should I be eating? Right? What should I eat? When I was younger, what should I eat to look better? When I was an athlete, what should I eat to make weight and be fit and perform? Later on, what should I eat to, again, look better again and also for my body to feel healthy? And I was trying to answer that question. I've gone to nutritionists. I've gone to dietitians. I've listened to doctors. I've listened to the USDA. I've followed word for word diets from people in men's health magazines when I was younger. And none of these things seemed to work. And at the same time that I was trying to develop a healthy relationship with food, I also was developing a number of different relationships, as thanks mostly to my parents, with not only them, but the world around me. So my father had me hunting and fishing and camping and trapping and all of that, since I could just about walk. My mother had me in the kitchen all the time. And in the kitchen, I was forming this incredible bond with my mother, and in fact, my grandmother's as well, as you can imagine. But still, since food was so weird in my life, I wasn't gaining a healthy relationship with food, but I was getting, gaining a great relationship with my mother and my grandmother's. And outside with my father, as you can imagine, I was forming these incredibly intense bonds with my father, but also a connection with my environment that was just so powerful. But there was something missing in every case, in everything that I was doing. I wanted something more. I wanted to not just pick up a gun and go hunting and shoot a deer. I wanted a deeper connection. I wanted to bow hunt, and then once I learned how to bow hunt, I wanted to learn how to make the bows. And then I wanted to learn how to make the arrows that went with the bow. And this sort of led down these rabbit holes. I didn't want to go to the grocery store and get vegetables. I wanted to learn how to forage. Those sorts of things were always consistent in my life at some level. And what I found out was that in order to learn to make that bow, because that was the key, right? In order to make that bow, I started to dive into this world of primitive technology. And I didn't even know this world was out there. And this is really before the internet. So I was finding out that there were actually people that still made bows out of one piece of wood with simple hand tools. And once I learned how to make the bow and eventually make the string, I wanted to learn how to make the arrow. And this was fine. I could get information and find people to help me with that. But I was stuck on the tip, making the arrowhead, because most people that make handmade bows, and there's more than you would imagine, and make handmade arrows, still put a metal tip on the end of it. And part of that is because of a number of different reasons, but one reason is because a lot of rules, especially in the US and different states, you're not allowed to hunt with stone tips. Well, I wanted to hunt with the stone tip. So I found some people who could help me learn how to make arrowheads, and that was fantastic. But I wanted to learn how to make, if I was going to go into all this effort and learn how to make a bow and an arrow and an arrowhead, and hunt deer. I was living in New Jersey at the time. I wanted to learn how to harvest a deer using the same equipment that somebody in New Jersey would have used 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago. So, but that information I couldn't find. That information didn't exist. So that's why, believe it or not, I turned to archaeology to start to answer those questions. But when I turned to archaeology to start to answer questions about the past, really, and my ancestry in many ways around the world, I found that I was also bringing a skill set to archaeology that really helped with this field called experimental archaeology. So I was coming at archaeology with these skills on how to make things with my hands the way people in the past used to make them. And this field of experimental archaeology, which is a brilliant field, is one in which we try to interpret the past by creating experiments using the same technologies and techniques and materials that people in the past would have used to replicate the technologies of the past and then use them to try to figure out how they were used, how they functioned, how efficient they were. So all of this was happening in the background at this time. I had all these queer, weird relationships with food. And then eventually, to sort of sum this part up, because I know it was sort of a long piece, to sum all this up, this is all happening. And I learned from some of the most brilliant primitive technologists and experimental archaeologists around the world how to make stone tools and replicate ceramic pots and nets and fibers and all of these things. And then when 16 years ago, when my oldest daughter was born, I was in the garage and I was banging on rocks because it takes a lot of work to become really efficient at stone tool production. And I was practicing literally every day for hours. And my wife comes out and she says, "Can you come in the house?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll be in a second." She goes, No, I don't mean like right now. Like, can you bring this passion, this information, all the stuff that you're doing and bring it into the house? Like, the stone tool thing is kind of neat, but you know, there has to be something more to this. If it's all that important, can you bring it in the house and have it help our family as well? And it was a tall order. I didn't really know how to, she was right, 100% right. Like, why do something if it's not helping the people that you care about the most? So I sat and it took me a long time to try to figure out what was the common thread amongst all these things I had been doing my entire life that I could actually use to help my family. And what I realized, it was a powerful realization, is that these technologies that I've been studying for, in many ways, a large part of my life, my entire life, date back to almost 3.5 million years ago. We started the first stone tool production 3.5 million years ago. What they all have in common is that almost every single prehistoric technology has something to do with food. Getting food, processing food, storing food, sharing food, consuming food, whatever. And when I thought about that, when I realized that, I'm thinking to myself, oh my gosh, like if almost every single prehistoric technology has something to do with food, all of this time and effort and millions of years worth of inventions and struggles and accomplishments, what does that mean for our diets? What does that mean for the way that we as humans eat? What is the relationship between these technologies and our diets and our evolving bodies and brains eventually to the point where we could produce humans? And it turns out it's a profound relationship, and it's a relationship that really sets us apart from every other animal in this world. And when I realized that, I realized that was my calling. That was my focus. I could now find a way to take all the work that I was doing and distill it down into something that could help nourish my family and the other people in my community or whoever else my audience might be. And so that's how I started to get involved with all of this.
Wow, that's awesome. That's an epic story. That's epic. So this whole question of diet and these tools playing a role in human evolution, obviously diet and hunting and specifically animal foods have played a massive role in human evolution. So can you kind of touch on some of the things that you learned about diet and how that affects our health and how that has affected our evolution as a species?
Sure, absolutely. So the first thing we need to realize, and in order to understand any of the rest of what I'm going to talk about, I have to make a statement that's going to sound very weird to the people listening here, but if you keep an open mind, if everybody keeps an open mind, I think you'll get a lot more out of the rest of this interview. So what I realized is that humans are one of the weakest species on the planet. We have an incredibly difficult time accessing food. So if you think about it, and this is the way I like to frame it, we love to celebrate the members of our species that really excel at something, right? So somebody like Arnold Schwarzenegger has huge muscles, or somebody that is a great sprinter, or somebody that's a great swimmer, or somebody that does, you know, whatever. And that's great to do. And those people do it better than the majority of the population do. But when we compare our athletic performance against other animals, we're really not that good at anything. I mean, we don't have the strength of an ant pound for pound. So yeah. If you think about it from that perspective and then think about it in terms of food, and getting food, we have an incredibly difficult time getting food. If we can't fly, if we can't run very fast, if we can't see very well, if we can't even dig into the ground efficiently, how are we supposed to get food? And the answer is we don't get food very well. And if you look back into the past, when before we were making tools to help us get food, our diets consisted of a limited amount of seasonal fruits and vegetables and some insects. And the best part of that diet were the insects. And that was what our diet were about 5 million years ago. Now, when we create the first stone tool at 3.5 million years ago, it may not seem like a big deal, but it was transformative. It transformed everything about not only how we got food, but our relationship with food. So if you can imagine for a moment the scene. So it happened on the African savannah. It was the earliest stone tool has been found just west of Lake Turkana in Kenya. And it was probably made by one of our Australopithecine ancestors that stood about 3.5 feet tall with a brain about the size of your fist closed up. Our nutritional requirements weren't very high. These guys were able to meet everything that they needed through insects and some fruits and vegetables. But they kept noticing that animals on the savannah, predators on the savannah, would take an animal down, hunt it down, rip it open. I mean, it's perfectly suited to do this. It's fast, it's strong, it's got huge canines and claws. They rip the animal open. They would go inside and eat the most nutrient dense part of the animal, which is the blood and the organs and the fat. They'd gorge themselves, and then they'd go off and sleep for some time. And after they would leave this kill, it provided time for other animals that didn't have those abilities to take that animal down, other animals to go in and feed off it, things like buzzards, for example. Well, our Australopithecine ancestors, built much like us but much smaller, couldn't go in there and rip that carcass apart and take meat and bring it back to the safety of their camp. So in this particular moment, this one day, 3.5 million years ago, one of our ancestors picked up two rocks of the right material, banged them together, and in less than a second created a durable sharp edge. And that durable sharp edge was stronger and sharper than anything on their body. And that durable sharp edge allowed them to butcher that animal quickly and take hunks of meat back to camp to share with the elderly and the sick and the children, and completely started to transform their diets. And now for the first time ever, meat was entered into the diet. And we see this, the earliest example of butchered animals with stone tools is about 3.4 million years ago. So essentially 3.5 million years ago. This is incredible. Now, so this is an example of creating a technology to overcome our physical limitations, allow us to interact with the outside world, and to access resources that were never in our diets before. And that's powerful. But here's the most important piece. For as inefficient as our bodies are at getting food, we are even more inefficient at doing something with that food. We have an incredibly inefficient digestive tract. Our digestive tract is about half the size that it should be of a similar sized primate. And the size of our guts, meaning everything from our stomach to our intestines, all of it, translates into our ability to eat. How much food can we eat? How long does it sit there? How well is it broken down? How well is it absorbed? And we don't have a lot of the things in our digestive tract that other animals have that allow them to naturally make food safe, nutrient dense, and bioavailable. In other words, when another animal like a cow eats something like grass, they have the anatomy to take that grass and turn it into something that their bodies can do something with. When a duck or a goose eats a grain of barley or wheat, they naturally are equipped to take that and turn it into something that their bodies can safely derive the maximum amount of nutrition from. But here we are as these incredibly weak humans, or Australopithecines at that point, finding ways to access new materials, new resources from our environment, but our bodies are not equipped to deal with those resources. So the best takeaway message from what we've created over 3.5 million years is not just the fact that we've created technologies to get new food, but more importantly, we've created technologies to take that food and make it safe and nourishing for our human bodies. And our human bodies grew. And our human brains grew in response to these things in our diets, but only because we were treating them the right way. In fact, we were eating foods that our bodies had no business eating and still don't, but we did it in ways that made that food safe and nourishing. So as far as animals and hunting are concerned, which I know was the beginning of this question, we started at 3.5 million years ago, we started butchering animals that other animals killed. So we were essentially scavenging, introducing meat, and it turns out a little bit of marrow, bone marrow, into our diets. We found on these sites not only the butchered remains of animals, but we've also found bones that were intentionally smashed to access the marrow. The interesting thing about that is that our bodies at 3.5 million years ago really didn't change that much. The introduction of meat into our diet didn't do much to transform us anatomically, at least not at first. What did change, and which is the, you know, a huge takeaway message here, is that 1.5 million years later, at 2 million years ago, we see the biggest jump in body and brain size in our ancestral past. In fact, a biggest jump almost to modern Homo sapien proportions. And this is when Homo erectus arrives, huge bodies, huge brains. And what fueled that, the change in the diet that really fueled that, is hunting. And now most people think hunting and accessing meat are the same thing, but it's not. And it's an important distinction because if you look at the predators on the savannah and how they operate, the first thing that they do when they take a kill down is eat the most nourishing parts of that animal, the blood, the fat, and the organs. And they actually leave the meat behind. They'll come back and get it later on, or sometimes they actually just leave it and never come back. But our scavenging ancestors at that time only had access to the meat. And I know we prize meat today, and meat's fantastic, but it's actually the least nutrient-dense part of an animal. What we could do, what we unlocked when we started hunting 2 million years ago, is the ability for us to have first access to those incredibly nourishing parts of the animal, the blood, the fat, and the organs. And when we did that, our bodies and our brains jumped in size.
Wow, that's awesome. That's an important distinction to make, is that when we actually started hunting and being able to access those really nutrient dense parts of the animal, that's when our body and our brain jumped in size. That's super interesting. So you obviously incorporate a lot of these principles into your life. And if you could give us what your take is on what is a biologically appropriate human diet and what humans are meant to be eating based off of this evolutionary history.
Sure. It's a loaded question that you ask, and I'll give you the best answers sure. that I can give, because they're not simple answers. So let me sort of preface the answer a little with a few statements first. One is, I do believe that our bodies appear anatomically the same as us. Ancestors of ours that are Homo sapiens appear 300,000 years ago. And when they appear, they are anatomically the same as us. In other words, their brains are just about the same size. Their bodies are about the same size. Their guts are the same size, operating the same way. So, and they appear in response to the changes in diet that are happening at that time. So in fact, in other words, another way to say that is our ancestors were doing so well at accessing resources from their environment and transforming those resources into something that was fueling these changes, supporting all of these anatomical changes, that I do believe that biologically we should really be looking into the past to nourish ourselves the best way possible, because those are the diets that literally built us as a species biologically. So there's something to this. I know there's a lot of fads and a lot of trends and paleo this and ancient this and ancestral diet this, but there really is something to it. Now, we could talk in a little bit about little caveats with that and things we might want to change, but there really are some very important reasons for looking to the past to understand, to get a grasp of the best diets possible for our modern human species. Now, that said, there's a ton of diversity. The only thing constant in our dietary past is that it's always changing. And in fact, it would be ignorant of me to try to say this is what our ancestors were eating and take 3.5 million years worth of diversity and you know, things happening all in many places all over the world and say this is what we're eating, because there were a lot of differences. So it wasn't that this group ate just meat and this group ate just this. But what I will say is that the constant, when I look at the archaeological record and try to incorporate that and interpret that and understand what all of that really means, what I can say is that the proper human diet is a diet that takes full advantage of whatever resources are at our disposal. And what I mean by that is that we have always sought out ways to create technologies to access the most incredible, diverse, nutrient-dense foods from our environment, and then take those foods and create technologies and employ techniques to make that food safe, nutrient-dense, and bioavailable. And I know I keep saying that, but that's the big takeaway key and the biggest difference between the way our ancestors ate and the way that we're eating today. We today take resources, process them for reasons other than safety and nutrient density and bioavailability. We do it for shelf life and shipping and the way it might look and the way this and this and this, at the expense of the nutrients and the safety. And we're feeling the effects of that. The answers that, you know, one thing I mentioned at the beginning of this interview was that my entire life I've been seeking the answer to the question, what should I be eating? And it turns out I was asking the wrong question, because our ancestors were eating many, many, many different things. I mean, there's some things we should talk about and some standards that we were always eating, right? Animal resources were always important to us and those sorts of things. But the answer to achieve true health, and just as importantly, to achieve true health in all senses of the word, and also meet or exceed our expectations of eating ethically and sustainably and economically, the answer to that doesn't lie in answering the question, what should I eat? It lies in answering the question, how should I eat? In other words, no matter what resources I have in front of me, how can I make the most of that resource? What technologies, things like fermentation or eating nose to tail or whatever, that I can use to take that resource and turn it into the safest, most nourishing food possible for my body? That's how our ancestors were eating. So in the terms of animals, you know, a lot of us pride ourselves, a lot of us that are meat eaters, especially in the modern world, pride ourselves on the fact that we eat, you know, all this meat. You know, in America, we eat really, and that we're doing it like our ancestors, but we're not doing it like our ancestors, right? Even those of us who are eating massive amounts of sirloins or whatever, because what we do in those of us that eat a lot of the meat, right, in the modern Western world especially, will eat the same three animals and the same cuts from those same three animals week after week after week. And there's nothing about that that's nourishing, ethical, or sustainable, or even doesn't make any economical sense either. And that's not the way that our ancestors ate. Our ancestors would take down an animal and start on one end, eat all the way to the other end, and then take down another animal. Now, there's you know, differences, and there were a lot of different ways these things played out, and there's certainly not always, because you know our ancestors were in tune with their environment and doing things on, you know, sustainably because they wanted to be sustainable. I'm not even suggesting that, but it was necessity and it was what worked. You kill an animal, you eat the entire thing, and then you go kill another animal. That is the way we should be approaching animals today. And if you look at the ratios of the macro and micronutrients in an animal, if you eat the entire animal, it is exactly what we should be eating as humans. The amount of fat, the amount of protein, the amount of whatever is in there. And if you eat the entire animal, you can get things like vitamin C and other major nutrients that we need that you can't get as easily from just eating the meat. So in our house, you ask what we do in our house, we have certain rules in our house if there's meat going to come into our house. Now, I have the advantage. I'm sitting here on the front porch now looking across the field, and I can actually see off in the distance the tree stand that my son and I hunt out of. So it's easy for us to hunt. We do a lot of hunting, mostly deer, a lot of waterfowl like geese and ducks as well, sometimes turkey and rabbits and squirrels, but mostly deer. And you know, the number one thing that we have in our house that we eat are is products from animals. I don't want to say meat because we're eating the entire thing. Animals that we've hunted and butchered ourselves. The next tier down, if meat's coming into our house, you know, the next thing we're looking to do is bring in meat from a farmer or local abattoir, a butcher that we know personally, and they know me and my wife and my kids, and that we've butchered and taken care of in our house. And then if all else fails, if that's not an option for whatever reason, then it's the most ethically sourced meat that we can get from the grocery store, which is a very rare thing because usually those first two take care of all of our needs. And we do that for several reasons. One, because that incredible connection that's formed with the entire experience of getting our hunting gear ready, going hunting, harvesting an animal, bringing the animal back, and then that's when the real work begins, when making sure that we're doing everything we can to use every single part of that animal. That is the most connected, nourishing, safe diet involving animals as possible. But even when we're dealing with local, local farmers, local abattoirs, local butchers, it's because, you know, not only do we want to support that system, which is an incredibly important thing to do, but that's a safe system, a system where everybody knows one another and we know exactly what hands have actually touched those animals and how those animals have been treated and those animals that haven't traveled very far. All of that plays, you know, they might be small pieces, but they're small pieces to a puzzle that's an incredibly important puzzle that we need to figure out how to piece back together to save our own health, but also the health of this planet. And it's also incredibly economical. You know, we'll buy a half a pig for $135 from the local butcher, take care of it here, and we have meat for weeks and can do exactly what we want to with each one of those pieces. And we're dealing with, you know, the marrow, and we're rendering the fat, and we're making pâtés, and we're cooking the kidneys, and we're using the blood, and you're using the skin. It's fantastic.
That's awesome. Yeah, you're inspiring me. I'm going to start doing that with my butcher now. So have you found it hard to kind of integrate this idea of eating nose to tail and embracing these traditional food ways with your family, or have they all taken it up pretty easily?
Wow, that's an awesome question. Well, when my wife and I first met, she was a vegetarian. So we met a little over 20 years ago, 22 years ago, and she was a vegetarian when we met. Only because when she was in a teenager, she had eaten at a restaurant and she ate something bad and got sick from it. And she just remembers that texture. But it was very interesting when she was pregnant, and I never pushed her. I have very strong feelings, just so you know. I firmly believe that the introduction of animals into our diets literally helped build us as a species biologically and culturally. I'm convinced of that. And I don't say meat, introduction of the entire animal. But it's not something I force on anyone, right? It's even my own wife. So, but when she was pregnant, she actually had cravings of meat again. And I'm sure it was the pregnancy. I'm sure it was her body just screaming to get the nutrition it needed to help support the new life that was growing inside of her. And it was a slow process because she had not eaten meat for so long. And then, you know, her idea of eating meat and my idea of eating the entire animal were, certainly in different arenas. And then when we started having kids, you know, when the kids were starting to grow and make their own decisions about what they were eating, I hadn't even fully figured out what my philosophy was on this, but I hadn't fully incorporated it into the family. And it's very interesting that it wasn't until about 5 years ago. So I have a wife, two daughters, and a son. So I have a 16-year-old daughter, a 14-year-old son, and a 12-year-old daughter. And my son and I do most of the hunting, although my wife did go this year. When we really started incorporating, I made it a conscious effort to make sure that these things weren't hidden from the family, right? The fact that we brought and it was met with resistance in the beginning. Instead of trying to, not that we were sneaking anything, but instead of trying to bring the deer into the garage to skin and butcher without, and making sure that nobody had to see it and, that kind of thing, or, you know, maybe I would clean a chicken before the kids got home from school. You know, I was doing those things, and it was actually to a detriment of everything I was trying to to instill into the family, right? I was keeping a face off of our plate. I was just falling into that same trap of what we as, you know, modern people feel is a convenience, that we don't have to think about death. We don't have to think that an animal gave its life, that we just, you know, just, why can't we just enjoy our sirloin and everybody leave me alone? That's exactly what I was playing into. And I realized it was the exact wrong thing to do. So I made a conscious effort to, I like to call it, putting a face back on the plate in our kitchen table. I made a conscious effort to show that, you know, here was the deer that my son just harvested. This is how we're taking it apart and have the entire family involved. And, you know, and it was met with some resistance in the beginning. And this continued. Even when, you know, I was bringing in pigs into the basement and butchering them, I have a big kitchen set up there. And now we do the pig and in the middle of the kitchen upstairs in our regular family kitchen. We just had one on the table 2 weeks ago. And what the really cool thing that changed in the dynamics in the family that changed as I started doing that was that everyone started to just realize this is what it's like. Things die for us to eat. And nobody in my house celebrates the death of something. We don't do that. We don't have animals hanging on the wall. We don't take pictures of things that we've killed. Because that to me is a necessary part of nourishing, you know, my family. The part that we really celebrate is all the parts leading up to the actual killing of the animal. And most importantly, all the pieces that afterwards, the real work begins, the real magic begins after, as soon as that animal's harvested, that's when the real work begins. And when you can actually work your magic to figure out how to make the most of that animal in every sense. And then it made its life worthwhile. So when I started doing more butchering in the view of the rest of my family, and in some cases involving them, everything started to change. So now it's a part of what we do, right? And as my kids grew up a little bit, you know, now that they're teenagers and they care about their own health and how their body looks as well, and realize that there's a huge, you know, relationship between what they're eating and how they feel and how they look. Things like pates and organ meats and using high quality animal fats the right way are now something that they're looking forward to as opposed to resisting.
Interesting. That's cool. I love that idea of putting a face back on the plate. I really like that. So you have been involved with this cool TV show called Modern Stone Age Family. Can we talk a little bit about that? What was the inspiration for that show, and what have been some of the highlights and some of the different places you've been to and different foods that you've tried, and really what was the inspiration for that whole thing?
Well, it started, so as I mentioned earlier, we were doing, you know, I've been doing some of this in many different pieces throughout my entire life. And finally, about 16 years ago, put the pieces of the puzzle together and started to form my philosophy and approach to food and diet and health and all this, and really started living that life and have been for the past 16 years or so. I started doing a lot of research around it. I started to incorporate in all of my teaching at the college, at Washington College where I teach. And then almost 6 years ago now, I was approached by National Geographic to do a show called The Great Human Race. And this show was a 10-part series where me and my co-host Kat Bigney were put into 10 different scenarios around the world, starting in Tanzania. And the idea was that we were going to recreate what life was like during that time period. And we were restricted to only using the tools and technologies from the time period that we were recreating, starting at 2.5 million years ago in Tanzania, and then follow sort of an evolutionary track across Africa, through the Middle East, across Asia, and then finally ending in Oregon in the U.S. at 4,000 years ago. And it was my job to recreate the technologies and the tools from that time period. And then we had to live for a period of about 8 days at a time in each one of these locations using only the period correct technologies. And I bring this up because, you know, about halfway through the season of filming, and it took about 9 months to film this, the head camera guy, Luke Cormack, amazing camera guy, he had the sort of unfortunate job of staring at me through a lens, you know, for 24 hours a day, days and weeks on end. And he was watching me more than I've ever been watched in my life. It was sort of scary, really. But so when we filmed this, what we would do is we would leave for about, each episode took about 2.5 weeks or so to film at a time. We'd leave for 5 weeks at a time and film two episodes. So we would go to a new place. We'd live with usually an indigenous group in the area. We'd learn about the plants that we could eat and the, you know, animals that were going to kill us and those sorts of things. And then we would film for about 8 days at a time. And when we were filming for 8 days at a time, what you saw is what you get. Like if we were sleeping in a cave, we were sleeping in a cave. If we were only eating what we foraged and hunted, that's all. So it was real. And then at the end of each episode, we had one day off, usually one and a half days off. And then we go to the next place. And then at the end of that, we would come home for about 2 weeks. I'd make new clothes and tools, and then we go back to the next place. So, you know, it was this really weird experience where we would, you know, I'm in a modern life here, and I eat a fairly healthy diet anyhow, but I was in a modern life eating a regular diet, and then I'm thrown into buckskins and stone tools eating just, you know, whatever we scavenge. And then for over a week, right, almost sometimes up to 10 days, and then they'd throw us in like a 5-star resort hotel for one night, and then we go into the field again, you know, at the new location in Ethiopia or whatever for 10 days, and then I'd be home for 2 weeks. So it was a really weird, I still haven't recovered from it in many ways. But so I say that to lead up to when Luke, the camera guy, was looking at me at this one moment about halfway through filming. And he says, you know, it's really weird. He says, I can see a change in your eyes every episode. Like you come in here and I'm looking at your face. And then 2 or 3 days in to each episode, your eyes get brighter. Your face changes, just everything about you and your aura, and just things that you would, you know, we would use as sort of physical markers to suggest health and vibrance. They all get better. And, you know, every time, so it was almost like this reset button. Every time I sort of returned to modern life, it was a reset button to whatever was normal. And then when I was eating these foods and this diet that was literally the closest anybody's ever come to what our ancestral diets were like, my body would change in a matter of days in a way that he could see it through the camera lens. And I could feel it myself. He was just verifying what I already felt. So I came back from that experience, you know, incredibly inspired, because, you know, me and my co-star Kat Bigney are the only two people ever in the world to have actually lived even a short period of time, but all the different major time periods in our evolutionary past. We actually experienced it. And we, most importantly, we experienced the diets. And that was like proof of all the things I had been doing for the 10, 12 years earlier, that it actually was working towards something. It actually made sense. So I, you know, when I came back from that experience, I dove headfirst in. Plus I had a travel bug in me then. I had, you know, I'd been to a couple different countries, but prior to that experience, but you know, we were in all over the world for that. And I just, all I wanted to do was learn more, meet new people, and bring my family with me. So 3 years ago, I was on, 2.5 years ago, I was on sabbatical to write a book. And my family and I, we relocated for the year to Dublin, Ireland. And we spent the year traveling the world, living and working with indigenous groups all over. Unfortunately, we didn't get to Australia. That's still on my bucket list. Yeah, but we were all over, and we were learning so many things. And the point of our work was to learn as much as we could from these traditional indigenous groups that still were doing something like they were doing in the past, some sort of food processing technology or approach that made incredible sense. And we went there to collect the stories, experience it, learn from them, and then come back. Then we came back and we were experimenting with ways to incorporate those lessons into our modern lives. And as we were doing this a newspaper, the London Times, did an article on us and called us the Modern Stone Age Family. So that's where the name comes from. And then, after we got back, we were working with a production company called The Workshop out of Philadelphia, and they were pitching a show about the work we were doing and wanting it to continue. And Curiosity Stream, a streaming network that's sort of like Netflix, but it's a subscription network. Did a pilot with us on some of this work, and it was kind of put together last minute, but it used some of the footage we had taken during some of these travels, and then we brought it all into the kitchen to show how we can take these lessons and transform. You know, it's not just a theoretical sort of academic exercise, or not just a travel show where you can go and, hey, that sounds really cool, and then you go eat a Big Mac. It's, hey, that's really, really cool. It looks strange, but now it makes sense. And hey, most importantly, I can do something with that in my own kitchen. So we're hoping it turns into a series at some level, although the current situation has sort of made an impact on travel quite a bit.
Yeah, it has for sure. Yeah, that's epic. That's amazing. I love, yeah, those stories, especially that showed the great human race. Well, I'll have to check that out. That's great. And yeah, if you ever make it to Australia, let me know. I've got some connections to some Indigenous people around here, so that'd be cool if you did an episode down here.
That would be awesome. And I have to tell you, it is bucket list level for me to try a witchetty grub.
Oh, yeah. I've tried one once. They're quite delicious. Like, I didn't find them that gross, but some people would, I'm sure.
They're huge, right? I mean, they're pretty big.
Yeah, they're pretty big. They're pretty massive. Yeah, cool, oh, man. Cool. All right. Well, I'll start to wrap it up. Is there anything more that you wanted to touch on or leave us with as we wrap this up?
Sure. You know, one thing that I think is really important that everyone to understand is that, you know, these are not foreign sort of weird approaches to food that, you know, are somewhere in our distant past and we've now risen above it. That's one perspective, or some people have the perspective, oh my gosh, all of this is too complicated. I could never do these things or work them into my modern life or do them in my modern kitchen. And it's exactly the opposite. I mean, these food transformations and approaches, things like fermentation, things like nose to tail approaches to foods, things like, you know, rendering fat and cooking with high quality animal fat, those sorts of things were all things that were done in like caves with stone tools and an open fire. Like, everybody who's listening to this, I can guarantee you, has a more well-equipped kitchen than any of our ancestors had. You can do these things. And the cool part of it is that once you do them and figure out how and why they work the way that they do, they're not this onerous task. They're things that, you know, do not distract you from your life. They enrich your life. And you can work your schedules around them. My wife and I have more than two full-time careers and three kids who are playing soccer and doing all the other things that, you know, field hockey and all the other things that the kids are doing in sports. And we literally make almost every single thing in our house entirely from scratch. And it's the best way to connect with your environment. It's the best way to connect with your community. It's the best way to connect with your food. And it's the best way to connect with your family. So here's my one piece, my two pieces of advice, I think, if you'll allow me. One is, I think that we all at some level should practice being a hunter-gatherer. Now, I know this may sound strange, and I, you know, I'm not suggesting everybody picks up spears and drops their clothes and runs naked into the woods. It's not what I mean. What I mean is the, you know, connecting with food by reading books and watching documentaries and then shopping differently at Whole Foods is great, but nothing can compete or compare with what it's like to pick a wild plant from your yard and use it on the dinner table, or to go fishing, or to harvest something from the woods if you're in a place that's you're allowed to hunt. And I'm not even suggesting that you need to hunt and gather for all of your food. We don't have enough resources in the world to allow everybody to do that anyhow. What I'm suggesting is that even doing some piece of that a couple times a year is a powerful, powerful experience that you know, connects you again with things like seasonality and local food and organic food and high quality nutritious food and all of the things that we were doing, you know, for millions of years. The second, so go fishing, go hunting, go find, everybody can forage. I teach foraging classes every year in the middle of Washington, D.C., literally urban foraging classes. We forage for hours, and you can't imagine the amount of food that we collect. There's nowhere in the world that I've been that you cannot forage. And it's an amazing thing to do. The second thing is, and this is going to sound like a big task, but bear with me for a moment. Identify the foods that you and your family eat all the time and learn to make those foods 100% from scratch. Now, I don't mean that you have to always make them from scratch from now on, although you might. I don't even mean that it has to be good. What I mean, and why I say this, is because there's never been more information out there about food and where it comes from than there is right now. But much of it is junk. Much of it's bias. All of it's bias at some level. But a lot of it is junk, and a lot of it doesn't help in any way. And if you're somebody that isn't already connected with every part of your food system, you don't know how to navigate in this confusing world of junk and information. But if you take the foods that you cook every day, and I mean the ones you eat every day, and even the boring foods. I don't mean taking a Christmas dinner and cooking that from scratch. That's a really cool thing to do, but it doesn't really solve any problems. You eat that once a year. Doing that from scratch once a year doesn't solve any problems. But take the foods that you eat every single day and learn to make it 100% from scratch at least once. And even if you completely screw it up, you know more about your food and your food system now than you ever did before. And you walk into and even if you always buy that food from now on, you are walking in the grocery store now as an informed consumer, and you're peeling back the layers of all the junk from the advertising and the marketing. And you are an empowered consumer that knows how to feed your family and where to put your money to support the people that are doing the right things with the food. So again, 100% from scratch. Try to make it a goal to make those meals so that nobody's put two ingredients together but you. And again, I know it sounds like a really hard task. It's a fun task, but and I don't mean to do it all right away, but take the ones you're doing the meals you're eating every single day and try to do that. And I'm telling you, two things are going to happen. You're going to be incredibly informed. And the other thing is you're going to realize that some of the things that you're eating all the time require massive industry, massive infrastructure and factories and scientists and lab coats with test tubes to produce. And if you can't make it in your own kitchen, you shouldn't be eating it.
I love that. That's great. Such a good point. All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Gulshinder, for coming on. For people listening, I'll put a link in the show notes to the different ways that people can connect with you. But I really appreciate your time and for sharing all your wisdom and knowledge with us today.
All right. Fantastic. It was great to talk with you.
Absolutely.
All righty. Thank you guys so much for listening in. I loved this conversation with Dr. Bill Schindler. I know you guys probably did as well. So as I mentioned in the show, all the links to connect with Dr. Bill are in the show notes. So if you want to head over there, check out some of his stuff. I love his Instagram account. I've been following him for a while. It's some truly inspirational stuff. So go check that out. Go check out more of his links as well down there in the show notes. And if you want to connect with me, all the links to do so are also in the show notes. And I just want to thank you guys for listening in. I really appreciate you guys tuning in. Let us know what you think. Give us some feedback. Maybe take a screenshot of this episode and share it on Instagram. Tag me, tag Dr. Bill Schindler, and let us know your thoughts. And with that said, thank you guys again so much for tuning in, and I will catch you on the next episode coming out on Friday.